GRL's Victory Vault, where we dive into the stories behind the cases that have made a significant impact on our clients' lives.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of GRL's Victory Vault, where we dive into the stories behind the cases that have a positive impact on our clients' lives. I'm Grant Gangstedt. Today, I'm joined by Matt Lindholm, a.k.a. The Wolf. How's it going, Matt?
I'm good.
You? I'm doing good.
Good.
Today, we've got a fascinating case involving an operating while intoxicated charge and some prosecutorial shenanigans, some misconduct that occurred during the case, and kind of some unexpected turns that eventually had a good impact for our client. So, Matt, welcome. Let's start with a little background on the case. I know it's an OWI case.
Yep.
Tell me kind of how this case started, how you became involved.
Sure. So, standard OWI first offense case is a bit unique in that when I got the call from the client, he had told me that he had done two different breath tests. And that's not uncommon because a lot of our clients tell us they've done two, breath tests, one being at the scene, preliminary breath test, and then one being back at the station. Well, this guy was adamant that he had done two breath tests at the station. And in the 20 plus years that I've been doing this, I've only seen that a handful of times. And so I continued to pressure him on it. And yeah, absolutely, two at the station. So I got to looking and started looking through the filings and pulling them up. And sure enough, he did done two breath tests at the station. One was just barely over the legal limit, and one was right at the legal limit. And they were done within a matter of minutes of each other. So it made it a unique situation from the start.
Okay, so we're talking about the legal limit being 0.080, right?
Correct. Yep.
And so you said one was right at the legal limit and one just above the legal limit. So what was that one that was just above the legal limit?
I think it was a 0.9 or 0.91, somewhere right in there.
Okay.
So
tell us what impact that has or how you view that.
Right. So in Iowa, you cannot legally use a breath test when you extract the margin of error or subtract the margin of error from that breath test. You cannot legally use that breath test to prove a violation of the statute for the per se alternative. So when I saw this, I'm like, all right, well, you take the margin of error off the 0.091, you're getting down there pretty low. But certainly when you take it off of the 0.080, they can't use that one. So we kind of had this bit of exculpatory evidence issue and just barely over the legal limit issue, which was very intriguing.
Okay, so let's break a couple of these things down. He talked about a margin of error, right? Yeah. So the breath testing machine itself, within that it has sort of a range of values where the breath test could be, right?
Correct.
And so 0.080, that margin of error is how much more or less than the 080?
So the margin of error by administrative rule is 0.004, 5%, whichever is greater. And generally, it's going to be the 5%. That's generally going to be the greater value. So with the 0.080 test that this client had, when you put the margin of error on it, it puts it down at 0.074, somewhere in that neighborhood. It's important to note too that these two breath tests were within a matter of minutes of each other. I think it was under 15 minutes in which each of these breath tests were obtained. So it wasn't like there was an extraordinarily long period of time in which these breath tests, breath test A was obtained here, and then breath test B was obtained over here. They were really close in time.
Okay. So another thing I want to make sure that we talk about is that there are two ways that somebody can get convicted of an OWI in Iowa, right?
Correct.
One is being over the legal limit of 0.08.
Right.
And the other one is being under the influence of alcohol, right?
Correct. There's actually the third of any amount of controlled substances in your system,
sure,
but or a combination of. But this was just an alcohol case. And so, yeah, the interesting thing about that was, when the charges were initially filed by the state in this case, they had both theories in there. They had the under the influence theory, and then they had the over 0.08 theory, or the what we call the per se theory. And then subsequently, the state filed a motion and said, we can't prove the under the influence theory here, so we're just going to go on the per se over 0.08 theory, knowing, however, when they did that, that they had these two competing breath tests that kind of offset each other.
Okay, so let's talk about the under the influence theory, right? Under the influence means that the person was affected by the alcohol,
right?
That they were in, that there was symptoms of intoxication, impairment, their ability to drive was impaired, right?
Visible manifestations of impairment.
Okay.
Yes.
Their mental and physical performance is impaired, right?
Right.
Okay. So you said that the state didn't believe that they could prove the impairment piece of this, right?
Correct.
So tell me about that.
So they actually filed a motion saying that there is not enough evidence here for us to proceed with the under the influence alternative for the operating while intoxicated charge. Meaning then that they had limited themselves to being able to try and prove the violation of the statute with only the test results.
Okay. So give me some insight as to why they didn't think, or what, in your opinion, why they didn't think they could prove the under the influence prong or theory of OWI.
I mean, my theory, I think, is reflected exactly in what the state filed, and that is they don't have enough evidence to do it. And by that, what I mean is that my client looked damn good on video. I mean, he, you know, there were no physical manifestations of impairment that you could see on video from this guy.
Okay, so when we talk about that, he wasn't stumbling drunk. He wasn't slurring his words, falling over.
Emotions were steady. I mean, he was answering questions appropriately. I mean, none of those things that, you know, a common layperson would look at to be able to say that guy's obviously impaired. I mean, he was rock solid on video.
Okay.
Answering questions appropriately, not slurring his words. I mean, everything was ideal.
So they then limit themselves to proving that this guy was over 0.08, the legal limit in Iowa.
Yeah, what they did is they filed a motion saying we can't prove the under the influence. We're asking to amend the trial information just so that it shows the per se or over 0.08 violation component of the statute.
Okay. And where that becomes problematic is that you said there was one test that was 0.08.
Correct.
Or 0.80.
Yep.
And one that was around 0.09.
Correct.
Okay. Tell me why that matters, or how that then went into your defense, or what your theory of the case was, or how you were going to defend that.
Sure. So, I mean, the theory of defense didn't change a whole lot because I knew we had these two competing test results, right? One that was, when you apply the margin of error, was clearly under the legal limit. And then one, when you apply the margin of error, was just over the legal limit. And all along, I knew that these were going to be competing pieces of evidence, one showing that he didn't violate the statute and the other one showing that he just barely violated the statute. But when they cut the under the influence component out of that, basically what they said is, the state said, the only way we can prove this charge is if the jury believes that this one test result was actually the truest accurate measure of the alcohol concentration.
Okay, so with taking into account that margin of error of the machine,
yep,
how the machine calculates it, that lower test result would have put them underneath of the statute, not in violation of the law, right?
For the one test, correct.
Right.
And just barely over for the second test.
Okay. So the only way that the jury can convict them is if they believe that second test and totally disregard that other test.
Absolutely.
Correct. Okay. Is that what the state wanted the jury to do, or how did the state proceed then?
So interestingly, once they eliminated the under the influence alternative, once they admitted in filings that we can't prove this component of this charge or this alternative of this charge, I went to the state and I said, you need to talk to the DCI people on this.
Because the DCI being
the Division of Criminal Investigation, who's in charge of breath testing, who the state has listed as their expert witness in this case to talk to the jury in the event it goes to trial about breath tests. I said, you need to talk to these people because I think what they're going to tell you is you're 09 or 091 test is just as viable as this 080 test. And that
so you can't they both come on from the same machine. You can't necessarily discount either one.
Exactly.
Right?
They're both valid tests. Okay. And that's exactly what the DCI said.
So the state wanted to essentially throw out the lower test and just have the jury proceed at looking at the higher test. Is that what you're telling me?
Not yet. Procedurally, after I told them, talk to the DCI, get back to me and tell me what you think. Well, they didn't talk to the DCI, or to the extent that they did, they didn't believe what the DCI had said. So my next move was to actually get the DCI people under oath. And by under oath, what I did was I did a deposition of them, put them under oath, and got them to say exactly what I had told the county attorney they were going to say at trial, which was that both of these tests are valid tests. You can't discount one over the other. But more importantly, they had also testified at that deposition that when we have these low breath test results, specifically a test result under 0.10, we have taught or trained officers that they should give two breath tests. And the reason they should give two breath tests is because the DCI and all of the testing that they have seen and done on people have seen that two tests on the same machine from the same person within a short amount of time can vary as much as 0.02, which is a big discrepancy.
Right. So if you're at 0.10, theoretically, you could be underneath of the limit.
Absolutely.
And not violating the law.
Absolutely. If they give you two breath tests.
Sure.
And, you know, to the DCI's credit, they also said that both of these tests are valid tests. You can't give one more weight than the other one. And
so just because one was maybe over the limit doesn't mean it's any more valid than the one that maybe was under the limit.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And that's inherent in the machine itself and the way that the machine calculates, you know, the breath alcohol concentration in an individual. Just like with any given machine, there's going to be some margin of error for the function that machine is completing.
Okay. So I'm going to take a wild guess here, and I'm going to guess that the state or the prosecutor wanted the lower breath test to can be completely disregarded and just proceed with the bigger breath test, right? Is that right? Or am I jumping the gun?
Nail on head. So after we did this deposition, the DCI agent said exactly what I said they were going to say. I went a step further, anticipating that the state may try to rehabilitate this higher breath test result with what's called extrapolation evidence.
Tell us what that is.
Extrapolation evidence is meaning that they want their expert to come back and say, well, this test, this 091, could have been in a range of X value to Y value.
And let me ask you this. So we take a breath test that's obviously after the person has driven, mm-hmm. right? After they're out of the vehicle. So extrapolation is that talking about taking the breath at the time that it's taken from the person and saying this is what it would have been at the time they were operating?
Absolutely. Okay. And it's trying to establish a range of which it would have been in at the time that they were driving. But there's certain factors that you have to know in order to make that scientifically reliable calculation. And the DCI expert admittedly said, I don't have that information, nor could the state provide that information to make that calculation.
So things like when they drank, how long prior to driving, those kind of things.
What they ate last time they, yeah, there's a whole bunch of different factors that go into it. But the state didn't have that information in order to make that calculation scientifically reliable. So I had kind of cut that ability out in the deposition for the state to do that. Now, interestingly, after the deposition, the state came in and filed a motion saying that the court, asking that the court exclude this 0.080 test result.
The lower test. But keep in the higher test. So try to say that that's the only one that the jury could consider and not consider the lower one that maybe put the person underneath of the legal limit.
Despite the fact that their expert had just testified in a deposition under oath that you cannot provide more value to one test over the other. They're both scientifically valid, reliable tests. But yet the state said, now we're going to try to exclude the one that is beneficial to my client.
tried to pigeonhole you.
Try to pigeonhole.
Okay.
And I might add, pigeonhole me without any real legal basis for doing so.
Right. Just kind of on a whim, they decided that's what they were going to do to improve their position.
Correct.
Okay. We've been talking about the state a lot.
Yep.
Right? Who are we talking about? What county was this?
Story County.
Okay.
Story County Prosecutor's Office.
Okay. And the Story County Prosecutor's Office is the county attorney's office, right?
Correct.
Now, was this a particular entity, person who was doing this, or what?
Good question. It was, and as this case kind of developed, I was unsure if it was, you know, this particular county attorney getting marching orders from the county attorney's office and the superiors that this county attorney had, or if it was just the county attorney doing this on his own. And come to find out, it was just him on the own and on his own, and the county attorney that was doing it, a gentleman by the name of Theron Christensen.
Okay, so an assistant county attorney,
correct?
Kind of doing whatever they were going to do, kind of cutting their own path in
correct.
This case.
Correct.
Okay, so he files this motion to try to exclude the lower test, proceed only on the higher test, which would have not allowed the jury to see that there was a potential for this client to have been underneath the limit, right?
Correct.
What happens at that point?
So they try to exclude this exculpatory evidence from...
And exculpatory meaning something that could benefit your client.
Correct.
Could prove them not guilty.
Correct.
Okay.
So, and what's interesting here, and the real trouble I had with this is, you know, prosecutors have a different ethical standard than criminal defense attorneys.
Explain that for us.
What I mean by that is prosecutors are have an ethical obligation to do justice, okay? That's different from a defense attorney's role. And the defense attorney's role is to zealously advocate for their clients. So there's a dichotomy there that prosecutors have to take a step back and step away from that win kind of at all costs sort of mentality.
Whereas, kind of do the right thing.
Do the right thing. And defense attorneys are under a little bit different ethical obligation than prosecutors in that regard. And the reason for that is, you know, prosecutors yield a great big sword of power when they come into these cases. And for the most part, defendants are wielding a shield. So, you know, for this prosecutor to say that, I'm going to attempt to ask the court to divest you of a very important piece of evidence for you to hold up this shield and defend your client against these charges in front of this jury. I mean, it was crazy to me to think that that's actually what the prosecutor was seeking to do. And specifically after we had just done the deposition of their own expert witness who had testified under oath that these are both scientifically valid and reliable tests.
So he wanted to keep his sword and take away your shield.
Exactly.
Okay. So he asks the court to take away this other breath test. What happens from there? What kind of legal proceedings occur?
Yeah, so I respond and I say I resist the request. I say there's no basis in fact or law for the request that's being made. And I ultimately ask that the court impose sanctions against this county attorney for trying to exclude evidence when there was no legal or factual basis to do so. You know, and sanctions is a method that you can invoke kind of the court's inherent power to impose a penalty against a party in a lawsuit or a criminal matter, you know, where they're trying to overstep the bounds and use the judicial process in a manner that there's no basis for.
Okay, so a way to deter somebody from doing it in the future, punish them for doing that kind of a
correct.
Thing.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
So how do things proceed from there?
So at that point, you know, we end up getting it set for a hearing. I had also simultaneously filed a motion to suppress in this case because what came to light in the depositions that I didn't know initially was that the officer who had stopped my client had failed to calibrate his radar equipment in his car, and he had stopped my client for speeding. So that kind of becomes an important issue that if you're using radar equipment that hasn't been calibrated, to stop somebody, how can you verify that, in fact, they were speeding with uncalibrated equipment?
Sure.
That became a separate issue in the case after we had done these depositions. That I probably
testing it for accuracy, right?
Yes.
The radar equipment.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I probably wouldn't have known that, but for having to do these depositions in the first place. So I'd filed a motion to suppress, trying to exclude all the evidence post stop, in large part because of this failure to calibrate the equipment. So we kind of have different things going on. We've got the motion for sanctions, the resistance to the motion to exclude the evidence, and then we have this motion to suppress.
Okay.
And it all got set for hearing on the same day.
So let me just try to break this down a little bit so we can understand it. So we've got this breath test issue where he's trying to exclude one breath test favorable to your client, and you're saying, no, you shouldn't be able to do that, and in fact, you should be punished by the court for doing that.
For asking to do that.
For asking to do that.
Yes.
And then a different issue, which is a motion to suppress evidence, meaning that you're trying to get evidence of the stop and subsequent evidence of the stop from the investigation out because there was a uncalibrated speed detection equipment issue where the officer was not calibrating his speed detection equipment.
Correct.
Right?
Correct.
So kick that out and sanction the prosecutor for trying to exclude favorable evidence but keep in the evidence that could convict your client.
That's correct.
Okay. So two separate issues. The only way you really found out about this stuff, well, the suppression stuff, is through a deposition.
That's correct.
Yep. Which is asking questions under oath outside of court to a witness.
Right. Right. We did a deposition of the state's witness through the Division of Criminal Investigation, their breath testing guy, and then we also did one of the officer. And the deposition of the officer brought the lack of calibration for the speed equipment to its head.
Okay. So you found out about it through that deposition process.
Right.
Okay. So we've got these two issues going on. They get set for a hearing on the same day. Kind of got the stage set here. Tell us what happened.
Yeah. So the night before the hearing, I get an email from Theron Christensen saying that
this is the prosecutor
saying that he's decided to, quote, let the bear go on this one.
What's that supposed to mean?
I don't know. I thought it was odd, especially when you couple that with, you know, the prosecutor's duty to do the right thing and do justice and actually get to the bottom of cases and not necessarily win at all costs.
So it sounds like he's trying to do the right thing here, right?
Well, yes, it did, but for the fact that he said, let the bear go on this one, right? Because that almost, to me, sent the message that I am engaged in a different duty than what my ethics require me to do. When he says, let the bear go, I mean, why? Why put that in there unless there's some, you know, hidden meaning to that email? So I say, great. You know, I respond, awesome. I'm set to be up there at 9 or 10 in the morning. I don't remember what it was. And
so what was your understanding he was going to do?
He was going to file a motion to dismiss the case.
Okay.
Which is what he should have done. And so, you know, 8 o'clock the next morning rolls around and I don't see a dismissal. Email him. He tells me it's been filed. The dismissal has been filed.
And you're here in Des Moines.
I'm here in Des Moines, still trying to get ready for this hearing. My client's kind of on standby at this point. He's taking time off of work.
You can't call off the dogs until you get an order from the court.
Exactly. So I then call the clerk of court and say, hey, I got this case. Has any motion to dismiss been filed on this? They say no. No motion to dismiss has been filed. So I respond to the county attorney, and at this point, I mean, it's go time. I've got to get in the car and make it up there in time.
Mm-hmm.
I say, hey, no, I call the clerk, no motion to dismiss has been filed, and I'm on my way. So, we go up there, and I end up taking another attorney in our office here with me, Sydney, with me, because I thought that there might be some need for further hearing or proceedings given the sanctions requests that I had made, even if he dismisses the case. And the reason I thought that was, you know, the case law on these sanctions issues are that even if a motion is or a case is dismissed, a sanctions proceeding can still be heard by the court after that dismissal. And so I wasn't sure if I was going to proceed on the sanctions issue or not. When I started putting the sanctions motion together, I had found out that this wasn't Mr. Christensen's first rodeo with issues like this. I had found two other instances in the limited research that I had done where he had done something similar, kind of made an allegation to exclude evidence that wasn't based in good faith on law or fact. So I included those in my motions, but I really wanted to go up and see what he was going to say, you know, why he was going to dismiss this case, because it was an about turn of face from what he had filed in his position he had up until the night before.
Because there was kind of two issues, right?
Right.
What was he going to base it on? Was it going to be the suppression issue? Was it going to be on this breath testing issue? What was his reasoning going to be?
Is that right? And I also should add that I had a motion to dismiss along with the motion to suppress, resistance to his request to exclude the evidence, and sanctions. So there was a whole host of issues kind of going on this particular day when he decided to dismiss the case on the eve of that hearing.
So he had a lot of stuff going on.
He did.
So you get up there. He said he had already filed a motion to dismiss.
Correct.
One was never actually filed with the clerk's office to their knowledge or your knowledge, right?
Correct. It did end up getting filed after I left the office on my way up there. By the time I'd gotten up there, a motion to dismiss had been filed.
Okay, so he wouldn't be honest with you, though. Before you'd left the office, it had not been filed.
It had not been filed.
Okay, so you get up there. You made it up there, right?
I made it up.
Okay.
Yep.
What happens at that point?
So we get up there and, you know, I show up for the hearing. He comes and talks to me in the hall. And I've got Sydney with more so because I wasn't sure if I'd have to testify to something, or I kind of just wanted her there as a witness more than anything. And he told me that the motion to dismiss had been filed. And at that point, I was like, all right, he did the right thing. So I was kind of the mindset that we were just going to let it go with the dismissal.
Client got a good outcome.
Right? Client got a good outcome. He still had to burn some vacation time. He had to pay for an attorney. You know, he was on edge for all this stuff going on. But ultimately, at the end of the day, the dismissal was the right thing. So I just asked him, I said, explain to me how we got to this point. You know, because I reflect back on this and I'm like, talk to the DCI people. He doesn't do that. We do a deposition. The DCI people testify under oath what I told them they were going to say, which undermines his case. And so I just wanted to understand kind of his mindset about how did we get to this point? Why couldn't we just let the bear go before we ever got to this
right
point? And his response to me was, and I'm paraphrasing here, but something to the effect of, well, I really didn't want other people to know or there to be a record of the fact that this law enforcement officer wasn't using his radar equipment with it properly calibrated.
Okay, hold on a second. So what he wanted to do was to dismiss this case before you guys had a hearing on this, so there wouldn't be a legal record of the fact that this officer had previous or that he had not calibrated his radar equipment in this case, but had also not done it for several months in the past, and therefore allowing other defendants to take advantage of that record and say, our case should be also dismissed because this officer wasn't doing his job right.
Right. That's my suspicion, is he didn't want a ruling from the court on my motion to suppress that said that this officer had not complied with the calibration requirements, and therefore any stops in which this officer was involved with this uncalibrated radar are going to have a problem. I think that's ultimately what he was concerned about.
So you get up there, you have this happen. It goes in front of the judge. He says he doesn't want to have this go forward because of this issue, right?
Yeah, so he, county attorney, tells me, well, I've dismissed this, so where do we stand on the sanctions issue? And he was of the impression that because he had dismissed the charge, the court didn't have authority to impose any sanctions against him for what he had done. And that's just not true. I mean, the court still retains the authority to sanction him, even though he had dismissed the charge. So ultimately, we went in, told the judge that we were agreeing to the dismissal of the charge, but we were not going to release or withdraw our motion for sanctions in this case. And I did that in large part on, you know, what the county attorney had told me in the hall, that he was doing this to try to cover up any ruling that would prevent or would preclude any other defendants from challenging their stops or their charges because of this officer's failure. So what really sat wrong with me was this county attorney was defending the fact that this officer was not doing what he was supposed to do.
So covering up for the officer, not really doing the right thing.
Correct.
It was just he was doing the right thing only because he was trying to cover up for the officer.
At first blush, I thought he was doing the right thing because it was the right thing to do. But as it turns out, he was doing the dismissal, the right thing, only to protect his officer and only to protect the ability for other defendants that had been stopped or arrested by this officer from having the same type of legal argument in their case.
So that those convictions could still hold on.
Correct.
Okay. So what ends up happening here? Does the judge go along with the prosecutor's argument that this is just in good faith, or what does he do with the sanctions?
So the sanctions hearing ultimately got bifurcated into two different proceedings. The first one was a determination as to whether or not the prosecutor had engaged in sanctionable conduct. And adamantly, all along, the prosecutor vehemently denied doing anything that was sanctionable conduct. And the judge ultimately, in a long, detailed ruling, found multiple violations of sanctionable conduct by this prosecutor throughout the course of this case.
So basically, he never walked it back. He just kept going forward.
He never walked.
Never said he was wrong.
Never took accountability for what he has done, and still to this day hasn't taken accountability for what he has done. So stage one of the sanctions proceedings was ultimately, did this prosecutor engage in sanctionable conduct? And the answer was overwhelmingly yes.
Okay.
By the court.
So they find that he does something wrong. Where are they going from there?
So at that point, the first proceeding, prosecutor didn't, you know, obtain an attorney, represented himself. Once the ruling came down finding sanctionable conduct, at that point, I was ethically obligated to inform, you know, the Iowa Bar Association that I think there might have been ethical conduct here. So I did that. And then ultimately, the county attorney retained their own counsel for the second part of the hearing, which was what sanctions should be imposed. And in between there, once the attorney was hired, they filed a motion to reopen the record and reconsider the judge's ruling, both of which were denied. But we ended up proceeding to the second stage, which was what sanctions going to be imposed.
So did they sanction this particular individual?
So he ended up getting sanctioned roughly $2,000. And in the grand scheme of things, it might not seem like a lot. But, you know, I'll sit here and I'll tell you, this was not a pleasant thing for me to do. I didn't get enjoyment in doing this. But I think, you know, as a defense attorney and for the defense bar, it was something I was obligated to do. We have to make these situations known to the public, to other defense attorneys, to judges, to county attorneys, that this just isn't something that we're going to sit idly by and let happen. And, you know, I know that not only the ruling finding sanctions itself has had a profound impact, but I also know that the sanctions that were imposed has had a profound impact. And both of those rulings have made their way onto the desks and emails of lots and lots of people.
So we don't want to obviously have the officer not doing their job, right? And if they aren't doing their job, we don't want the prosecutor to cover up for that. And we want them to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, not just to cover for the officer, right?
Not only is it the right thing to do, I mean, just morally the right thing to do, but it's the ethically obligated thing
right, that
they're required to do.
Right. And so he kind of didn't put the shovel down. He never admitted he did something wrong. The court sanctioned him for it. And in doing so, they've said, you can't do this. This is wrong. They hit him with some sanctions. It also tells the rest of the legal community or other prosecutors that this is wrong too, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So that's one of the big impacts here, right, is that this helps people in the future, other prosecutors, not make those same mistakes.
You know, there's a micro and macro level here on the positive impact, right? The micro level is that the $2,000, when and if it ever gets paid, will help my client offset some of the costs that he had to endure because of this conduct. The more macro level is that this thing has created a stone in the water ripple effect and is verberated out in the legal community that at least if you come to our firm and try to do these types of things, it is not something that we're going to stand by and let happen.
Right. So in this particular case, got a good result for the client. That was the dismissal.
Right.
And the broader impact was that telling this prosecutor this is not acceptable and telling other prosecutors this is not acceptable as well.
Correct.
We're not going to take this lying down.
Correct.
And it's kind of a double result there, like you said, the micro-macro thing.
Right.
That this helps other people in the future, helps other legal professionals in our field, and helps future clients.
And I hope emboldens other attorneys in our field to call out this same type of behavior and bring this type of behavior to the attention of judges and the public and anybody else that'll listen. Because if we're not doing it, who's going to? And if we're not doing it, then this behavior just gets reinforced each and every time that it happens and they get away with it.
Sure. Got to call it out when we see it, right?
Absolutely.
That's what we do here at GRL. Well, I'll tell you what, Matt, thank you so much for being here, sharing these experiences, insights with us. It's been really eye-opening to hear about this case. It's and the positive impact it brought not only for your client, but also, you know, the greater impact it could have on the legal community too. So, well, thanks for being here to our listeners. Thanks for tuning in. Join us next time for another episode of GRL's Victory Vault, and we'll get to more stories of positive impacts for our clients.